listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Lawrence Wechsler is a native of Los Angeles, which is very important to his work. I believe he went to Grant High School. We'll have to check. He's commonly regarded as one of the foremost practitioners of literary nonfiction. They've been playing with whether it's literary nonfiction, narrative, creative nonfiction. He likes literary nonfiction. His essays long appeared in The New Yorker, and one of his most recent books, Everything That Rises, out of McSweeney's, was celebrated with a National Books Critics Circle Award for criticism. His latest collection, which we have on sale tonight, Uncanny Valley, Adventures in the Narrative, a companion to the earlier Vermeer in Bosnia, continues the author's distinctive blending of political and cultural themes. Lawrence, or Ren Wechsler, currently directs the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, where he cooks up all kinds of creative mischief. I was just hearing about some mischief he's planning to cook up. And as well, he is concurrently the artistic director of the Chicago Humanities Festival. Whether Ren is writing about art, David Hockney, or Robert Irwin, or cultural politics, the solidarity movement in Poland, or the very nature of narrative itself, he can be counted on to bring humor, intelligence, curiosity, and grace to his subject. His newest collection, Uncanny Valley, examines subjects as diverse as the theater of Dario Fo, human rights in Rwanda, the film made of Anthony Swofford's Iraq memoir, Jarhead. There is one subject that is particularly dear to his heart, and that is the subject of European artist emigres in Los Angeles, those who fled the political catastrophes that uprooted the modernist movement in the arts from its places of origin in Europe and made its survival dependent upon exile in foreign and especially American venues. Wechsler's grandfather, the eminent composer Ernst Toch, was such a refugee, and Wechsler has written several beautiful essays about his grandfather. One is included in this new book titled Popocatepetl, My Grandfather's Geographical and My Medical Fugue. So tonight, with David L. Ulan, author of The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time, and book critic for the Los Angeles Times, Lawrence Wechsler will discuss From Exile to Home, Literary Life in Los Angeles. Please welcome David Ulan and Ren Wechsler. Thank you.
Okay, so as Louise just mentioned, we're going to talk for about 45 minutes or so, and then we're going to turn it over to questions from you, so pay attention. Broad subject is Southern California and the literature of exile and place. And one of the things that we were talking about in terms of framing this conversation was the idea that Los Angeles literature was, for a long time, a literature of exile, where people came from elsewhere and sort of explained the city or the region, sometimes well, sometimes badly, to us. But that there wasn't really an indigenous literary culture. And then at a certain point, and we can discuss this or debate it, my sense is sort of probably early 1970s. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I date it that way. Actually, I do know why I date it that way. But
why do you date it that way?
Because of Wanda Coleman, actually, in a strange way. Okay. Because I think she's sort of one of the early... She started writing for the LA Free Press in the late 60s and early 70s and really was a kind of early signature voice, and I think opened up doors in a lot of ways. Anyway, it became a kind of literature of place, and there was a fundamental shift in the way we think about the city. It went from being a literature of exoticism to being a literature of what, or in some ways, a literature of what D.J. Waldy calls sacred ordinariness, which is a phrase I love, and I think that only, or maybe not only, but particularly in Los Angeles, the idea of sacred ordinariness would become a kind of radical idea because it's a city that doesn't really embrace its ordinariness. Anyway, that's sort of the setup.
That's the premise.
Let's start. And also, we were realizing earlier that we are both exiles in our own way. You have a Southern California native who lives in New York. You have a New York native.
Birmingham High School.
And a New York native who lives in Southern California, you can tell by how we're dressed.
And look what happened.
Which side? We've both gone native. So
I can come home.
All right, here we go. I didn't realize there was a striptease component to the conversation.
Okay.
Anyway, let's start by talking a little bit about this kind of the literature of exile, but in the context, I think, of let's start with this sort of European exile community around the war. There was a huge artistic exile community here, spanning all the arts.
Yeah, and the émigrés in general, and this is this astonishing from all over Europe, but because of Hitler largely, and they flood into America. Most of the artists stay in New York. Most of the architects go to Chicago, interestingly, partly because if you think about that was because the Chicago fire had made it flat and they could start from scratch, and it wasn't that generation but the next generation. So you have Sullivan and people like that, and then it goes into Mies van der Rohe and Gropius and so forth from Chicago. To Los Angeles come the musicians, because you had in those days probably the three greatest orchestras in the world in Los Angeles, which were the studio orchestras. They weren't the LA Philharmonic. They were just filled with just incredible musical talent. A certain number of composers. You had a few architects, specifically Neutra and Schindler, are the major ones. And you had a flood of writers. And the writers are partly drawn because of Hollywood, and partly because other writers were here.
I want to ask you about that, because you do have some of the writers, interesting choices of writers. Brecht, who famously made attempts at forays into Hollywood.
Yeah.
But then you also have writers like Mann, who did not really, right?
Yeah. Mann is a...
Or the Manns, I guess we should say.
Well, Thomas Mann and Leon Feuchtwanger are exceptions in that they are successful as writers.
Right.
They're Book of the Month Club book all the time, and so they can afford not to. Thomas Mann's brother, who in Europe was thought the superior Mann, Heinrich Mann, he ends up trying to write for Hollywood, completely hopeless. And then just this incredible number of Brecht, Arnold Dublin, and by the way, not Isherwood, Huxley. And then you also have this phenomenon of Adorno living, north of Wilshire on Kenter. By the way, I was going to show you this. Years ago, and you might remember the LA County Museum did that fantastic show where they recapitulated the degenerate art show that had taken place in Munich in 1937, one of the great art shows of all time, far and away the most attended art show during Nazi Germany, all about these disgusting modernists. And then 5 or 6 years later, Stephanie Barron put together a wonderful show about what happened to those artists, and it was called Exiles and Emigres, and it was about all over the country, but I did the essay on Southern California, and my great contribution to the scholarship in this is the map to their homes.
It's the artist version of the Stars map.
And what's fascinating, here's all the, this took a lot of work time, but all the, and it basically, it turns out that they're all living on 1 mile on either side of Sunset Boulevard from Silver Lake to the ocean. So it's from Richard Neutra to on the far side, you get Leon Feuchtwanger, but you also get Max Reinhardt, Charles Laughton, Bertolt Brecht. Brecht lives on your way home, if you're going back to Santa Monica, 26th Street and California. It's a T intersection. If you were to keep driving, you would hit a house that looks like it's Mark Twain's house, and that was Brecht's house.
Right. Wait, this is the first house or the second house?
That's the second house.
That's
the second house. Yeah. And what's great about it is I collect all kinds of hilarious stories about these characters. Brecht coming home and seeing his daughter wearing what passed for a bikini in those days, those two-piece swimsuits, and telling her to go back in the house. She looks like a tramp. But the whole dissonance between them and so forth. And I had. So there's all kinds of stories here that are fun to tell. It's interesting, actually. We can maybe go on. Let's turn on the projector. Years ago, around the time the show was happening, I did a collaboration with Drew Friedman. I don't know if you can see that, but for Los Angeles Magazine, Howard Stern, and Drew Friedman is Bruce J. Friedman's son, And he's a wonderful, wonderful illustrator, cartoonist. And I thought maybe I could just read you a few of these things because they are.
And do we have a couple of slots? Can we?
I'll show you a few other ones. But this one here it reads, "Wherever I am," the novelist Thomas Mann solemnly used to say to the hearty concurrence of his fellow emigres, "There is Germany." But Los Angeles was very pointedly not Berlin. The rich tradition of popular immersion and high culture that had grounded creative life over there, which, by the way, if you think about it, Berlin is the one place where the avant-garde went mainstream for a period of about 10 years.
Right.
The most avant-garde was the mainstream.
And while we're doing this, hold that thought, because I also want to ask you about that intersection of high culture and mass culture in Los Angeles through the intersection of Hollywood.
Yeah. So, but anyway, just continuing here, was replaced here by what composer Ernst Krenek once characterized as the echolessness of the vast American expanses, or what the conductor Henry Temyanka often described as Southern California's primary trait, an unlimited indifference and passive benevolence toward everything and everybody. Emigres used to console one another with the story of two dachshunds that meet one day on the Santa Monica Palisade. "Here it's true I'm a dachshund," one tells the other, "but in the old country I was a St. Bernard." And my grandfather was a St. Bernard in the old country. And there were many ex-St. Bernards there on the Palisade. One of them, the writer Bruno Frank, used to make regular evening pilgrimages to the Palm Colonnade, where he'd occasionally startle strolling passersby. "There," he would announce wistfully while pointing out over the water toward the setting sun, "there lies Germany." And no one had the heart to tell him that, well, actually, no, there lay Japan. I'll just show you. Should I show a few others?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see.
This one, I think.
This is from Thomas Mann's diary. "Thursday, April 14th, 1938, Beverly Hills. Got to sleep late. Fan a dorm. Drank coffee. Wrote a page and was stimulated. Outing to the beach with the Huxleys," Aldous and his wife. "The weather clearing rapidly and becoming warmer, where we got out and took a rather long walk along the glistening blue and white ocean at ebb tide. Many condoms on the beach." "I did not see them, but Mrs. Huxley pointed them out to Katya." And let's see, I'll go to just one other. Let's see. Oh, this is fun. Let's see here. "It was entirely possible for the emigres in L.A. to go weeks without having to dust off their fall to English." In a loving memoir of his director father, Gottfried Reinhardt, the son of Max Reinhardt, describes an evening at the Clover Club, a gambling casino on Sunset Boulevard, in the company of the legendary Otto Preminger. As it happened, they were the only two non-Hungarians at the roulette table, and the agglutinative language of their neighbors began to grate on Preminger. Finally, he pounded the table and shouted, "God damn it, we're in America, speak German!"
Let's do one more, and then I want to ask you about some of these juxtapositions.
Okay, I'll get a shot. This is Brecht. So here we have Brecht. Let's see here. "Wherever I go," the great playwright Bertolt Brecht wrote in a poem about his Hollywood exile, "they ask me, spell your name, and oh, that name was once accounted great. But what had he done for anybody lately? Every morning to earn my bread, he recorded another poem titled simply Hollywood. I go to the market where lies are bought. Hopefully I line up with the sellers." Correct use of the word hopefully, by the way. "It remains one of the abiding scandals of the Hollywood 40s that during the 6 years of his sojourn here, Brecht, arguably the premier playwright of the 20th century, managed to see only a single one of his screenplays carried through to completion, Fritz Langmann's Hangmen Also Die, which Brecht subsequently disowned. On the other hand, maybe the studio heads deserve a moment of sympathy as well. In his memoirs, Gottfried Reinhardt recalls how they were regularly getting pitched such Brechtian brainstorms delivered in his, quote, unadulterated Bavarian accent, unquote, as a riveting proposal for a film about, quote, the production, distribution, and consumption of bread.
which is an amazing thing.
By the way, if you could see it, it says Brett on the notes. You know,
but Brecht did. I mean, he did move to the second house after he got some yep. movie money. It was a classic sort of story. Yeah. I want to ask you. I want to go back to Brecht because he, to me, is one of the most interesting figures of that community. But before we do, what about? I mean, let's sort of trace the shape of the community. It was not just a German exile community, as you were saying. There were other Europeans. There were mm-hmm. British. I have the image of Mann and Huxley, the Viertels, and the parties that they threw. All those kind of things. What was the kind of critical mass? I mean, what was the?
I mean, I think again, it's Hollywood. I think among the writers, certainly. And the critical place was Saul Kapfirtel's house. And by the way, the single great book on this subject is out of print. It's Saul Kapfirtel's memoir, The Kindness
and
of Strangers.
For those of you who don't know who Saul Kapfirtel is, will you just sort of first sort of set her up and then
she was an actress in Germany, in Vienna and Germany, coming actually from Poland originally, in Max Reinhardt's studio, the most formidable there was. She marries Bertolt Viertel, who is another director, also formidable, who becomes a film director. They come here before 1933, actually, in the late 20s to do filmmaking. She eventually becomes Greta Garbo's. She stops acting. She doesn't look like an actress. She becomes a screenwriter, a very good screenwriter, and she becomes Greta Garbo's screenwriter. She basically has the salon. It's on Mayberry Road. It's the house where Dan Sullivan lives now, actually. But before that, it's 165 Mayberry Road, I think, and which overlooks Rustic Canyon. And it became the place where on any given Sunday you would find Johnny Weissmuller in fervent conversation with Arnold Schoenberg. You know, right. And Greta Garbo not talking while with Isherwood talking to her, and I mean just all these strange, wonderful, crazy combinations. It was also a place where it was a headquarters of activity to try and save other people, and a headquarters of what subsequently would be known as premature anti-fascism. You were not allowed to be an anti-fascist until 1941. If you were an anti-fascist before 1941, it was subsequently proof that you were a communist.
Right.
And many of these, Brecht, Eisler, Voigtwanger came under the cloud, but Thomas Mann eventually leaves, and so forth. But this memoir...
Well, Mann was one of the only ones who wouldn't sort of either dance around or disavow communism.
Yeah, no, there's a fantastic... let's talk about the time during the war and then talk about the communism. Yeah. But Salka's... This is just such a beautiful book. And is there a publisher in the house? Seriously. Millions of dollars right here. And Marta Voigtwanger once told me that the really, really great thing about this book is what she left out. It is done with such taste and such... It's so human. It's profoundly, deeply about marriage. She and Bertolt become more and more apart. They both take other lovers, but they remain very close. She eventually wants to rush back to his deathbed when he's in Europe, and she can't go because they won't give her a passport because she was a communist. It's just heartbreaking. But it's written with such beauty, and there's these very funny scenes, but then just one thing about the war, what the war was like in terms of the relationship between these émigrés and what was going on abroad and being here. She has at one point, she writes, "The unconcerned sunbathers on the beach, their hairless bodies glistening in brown, the gigantic trucks rumbling on the highway, the supermarkets with their mountains of food, the studio with the oh-so-relaxed employees, the chatting extras pouring out from the stages at lunchtime, the pompous executives marching to their exclusive dining room or to the barber shop, stopping to flirt with the endearing young talent. all these familiar scenes were a nerve-wracking contrast to the war horror I constantly imagined. And this kind of, well, the phrase became Exiles in Paradise. I mean,
So do you, do you see that the kind of the tension there between sort of the frivolity of the scene and the sort of seriousness with which they
what they were doing.
Yeah,
I mean, I was going to read just a funny thing in my book about Robert Irwin, which is describing exactly the same time period. Mm-hmm. At one point, I'll just pass, and then we can go to answer that question. But Robert Irwin, as you may know, would have been about 16, 17 during the war. Right. He was having this fantastic life. The way he this is the artist Robert Irwin, who I wrote about in my book Seeing is Forgetting. And he has this high school life. It's girls and dancing and cars and so forth and so on. At one point,
a great riff on Coca-Cola.
He does Coca-Cola. At one point, he mentions that, and that's where we would siphon gas because it was being rationed in those days. This was the first time the war had impinged on Bob's recollections, and I wondered whether it had any more significance to him at the time. "Oh, no," Bob responded immediately. This is him in his 60s telling me this. "We were just oblivious. We conducted ourselves like the war wasn't on in any way. Not having gas and all that was simply a challenge. I didn't have any older brothers, and come to think of it, none of my friends in that group did either. Maybe that was part of it, but basically we just didn't pay any attention." I asked him if the obliviousness of the local youth had bothered the older members of the community, whether he and his friends were criticized as irresponsible. "I don't know. I mean, if I was oblivious to the war, I was certainly oblivious to any criticism." Irwin was 13 at the time of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, just graduating high school as the war ended. I asked him where he had been on December 7, 1941. "I don't know," he replied. I asked him about the day the war ended. "Haven't the slightest idea." "Hiroshima?" "Nope, Hiroshima no more is the story of a fairy tale." I wondered if part of the reason he and his friends were having such a fiercely good time was because they all realized they were presently going to be shuttled off to war. "Oh, no," Bob dismissed the notion with a sweep of his hand. Look at it here. Look at how it is. Calm, sunny, the palm trees. What is it to get all fucking upset about?" He laughed. "This is reality. In other words, the war was not reality. The war wasn't here. The war was someplace else. So any ideas you had about the war were all things you manufactured in your own head from newspapers and that. To me, this was reality. This was my reality right here."
All right, so let's talk about that tension, because that's a really potent tension between... Yeah. What he's saying and what Viertel is saying.
Absolutely. So, you know. And those Germans, I mean, Thomas Mann is spending his time writing arguably the great German novel of the war, which is Dr. Faustus, which has its own comedy, but we can deal with that later. And Brecht, and they are just, it's just racking to see this. And their lives, and my own grandfather basically becomes just blocked. I mean, he can't compose anymore. He's having to compose for Hollywood. One of the things you had to realize about what was going on was that they had to get affidavits. So if you had family in Europe still and you wanted to bring them over, you had to deposit something like $2,500 in a bank account as a surety that they would not be become a ward of the state.
Right.
And you had to do it for each one. So if you had a family with three, you know, you had to do that. And even so, the bureaucracy of trying to rescue people, to the eternal shame of the United States, it is a fact that the admittedly already low quota for Eastern Europeans and Central Europeans, which was part of the immigration law, was not met during those years. The State Department Immigration Office was headed by an anti-Semite, right, who did not want them coming. And you can say what you will about Switzerland and so forth, but it wasn't much better here. Mm-hmm. The flip side of that, I remember I was once giving a talk in Berlin about my grandfather and telling a story about how when he first arrived in America, he had a news conference. He was a major composer from Europe, and he had a news conference, and he told the local press, please don't try to take this music and force it into categories that you already have, because it's a different kind of thing. Let it, instead, just listen to it carefully and let it make its own chambers, you know. And he went, you know, very carefully talked about this. And then one of the reporters asked what his favorite meal was, and he said steak tartare. And the headline the next morning was "Eats raw meat," you know. And I told exactly that story to this Berlin audience, and the Berlin audience laughed uproariously. I said, "You know, no, it's true. They were a bunch of Philistines over there, you know." And I, it was ridiculous. They had no culture. It was hopeless.
But was there? But, any,
and then I said, "Go ahead." But at least they weren't trying to kill him,
right? But was there a place? was there a place in which these cultures could somehow merge? I mean, I think maybe it's Hollywood, or maybe it's not. But I mean, Exiles in Paradise. How much of paradise seeped in?
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, there's the great story about Schoenberg walking on the palisade, and some kids coming toward him, and they're whispering very excitedly, and they're pointing at him, and so forth and so on, and they say, "That's the Schoenberg kid's father." The Schoenberg kid was a tennis star at the high school, so there was that kind of weird merging where there was a distance. The Germans and the Austrians kind of stayed among themselves. And at that point, you could spend your whole time not encounter anybody who didn't speak German.
Sure.
Having said that, in the studios, precisely, I mean, that is one place where really, I think, over and over again, things that we just take for granted as great, great classic American things, Some Like It Hot, Ninotchka, these are all operettas from Vienna that just get translated. The Billy Wilder, the whole kind of zesty storytelling. And in fact, you can do another kind of thing that if you think about it. In Germany, you have Fritz Lang, and you have this expressionist cinema that's very tense and anguished and so forth. And those guys come to America, many of those directors, Preminger and so forth, and Wilder and so forth, and that becomes film noir. Film noir because they can't deal with L.A. light.
Right.
You can't tell those stories in that kind of light.
Right.
And instead, it's dark and so forth. A phrase that gets invented by the Cahiers du Cinéma people,
right?
And then you get Breathless, made in France, which is an homage to an American style, which was in fact came from Europe in the first place. And then you get the Americans, Altman doing The Long Goodbye, or the
even the use of noir now as a kind of genre label for American crime fiction.
And all that's this kind of back and forth that happens all the time. So there's been this incredible imprint in popular culture in that sense.
Right.
But the high culture, Brecht, Mann, and so forth, largely didn't leave an imprint on the literary side. It seems to me.
Don't disagree. Yeah. I mean, I want to, and I want to ask you about this. I'm trying to decide if I want to ask this other thing first. Let's stay with this, and then I'll go back. I want to ask you about kind of the impact. I mean, obviously, architecture, there's a big impact, music, etc. But it does seem to me that the literature, that the writer exiles, the exile writers, don't really engage very much with the culture, not only in terms of not influencing or not having an influence, but also in terms of not even engaging it for the most part, except for Brecht writing those poems, in their work.
Well, an interesting, curious one is Feuchtwanger, who does write two novels. He writes a novel about Benjamin Franklin in Paris, and he writes a play called The Devil in Boston very early in the McCarthy era, which uses the Salem witch hunts as a metaphor for the McCarthy, the rising anti-communist hysteria, a good 3 or 4 years before Arthur Miller.
Right. Interesting. And you can argue, I might argue that Galileo, that Brecht's Galileo, whatever else it does, it almost predicts Brecht's own appearance at HUAC, right?
In the sense that he goes from the premiere to HUAC and keeps on going.
Right, exactly.
We had talked about Thomas Mann a second ago,
right.
and I can find you a great passage. I took it out my page. Well, let me see if I can find it quickly. I'm passing the page where Gidget, you know, that's an emigre. That's Frederick Kohner, the brother of the great agent who is trying to make sense of his daughter, who's American, and he writes Gidget. But Thomas Mann, he at one point writes this passionate thing about where he says, "I have the honor to expose myself as a hostile witness. I testify that I'm very much interested in the moving picture industry and that since my arrival in the United States 9 years ago, I've seen a great many Hollywood films. If communist propaganda had been smuggled into any of them, I, for one, never noticed anything of the sort. I testify, moreover, that to my mind, the ignorant and superstitious persecution of the believers in a political and economic doctrine which is, after all, the creation of great minds and great thinkers, I testify that that persecution is not only degrading for the persecutors themselves, but harmful to the cultural reputation of this country. As an American citizen of German birth, I finally testify that I am painfully familiar with certain political trends. Spiritual intolerance, political inquisitions, and declining legal security, and all in the name of an alleged state of emergency. That is how it started in Germany." And he goes on. And then a few years later, he just can't take it anymore, and he leaves, and he tells a story about, I'll read it. "Within a few months, he had decided to immigrate once again, this time to Switzerland, where he would live out his last 3 years. Preparing to leave, he made reference in another of his letters to a story he'd heard about one friend who was sailing from New York to Europe, while another was sailing in the opposite direction. As their ships pass on the high seas, they recognize each other and both cry out in horror simultaneously, 'Have you gone crazy?'"
But still, I want to come back to Brecht because I think, you know, Brecht, for all of his inability to crack Hollywood, did major work here. Several of his major plays. Galileo was premiered at the Coronet Theater.
And also, the translation of Galileo is an amazing story because he and Charles Laughton, who don't speak each other's language.
Right.
Laughton had a Bible in his pocket and Brecht had a King James Bible and Brecht had Shakespeare in his pocket. And they would sit on the house that recently came down that was on the Palisade that used to overlook Temescal Canyon and so forth, and that was Laughton's.
That was Laughton's house, right.
And they would sit out on the patio out there, and without either of them speaking a word, they translated it together with great passion,
right.
And that's that translation.
And so Laughton directed, it's a great moment. I love the fact that it takes place at the Coronet, that it premiered at the Coronet, but it's a great moment of sort of, or maybe the one moment where of bleed through, where the high culture, mass culture, the exile community, Los Angeles as a place, sort of Hollywood and the theater world, or all of these people are sort of playing, they're coloring outside the lines together in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I don't know quite what I make of it. I love it as a story. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
I mean, it's an amazing story, and there's a great, great passage, which I may read in a second if we're not getting bored with from Shelley Winter's autobiography. How many want to hear Shelley Winter's autobiography? I'll tell you, it's really good. But let me first say that a fascinating thing is that you have these spectacular writers, Heinrich Mann and so forth, submitting to the studios. You have Irving Thalberg interrogating Schoenberg to try and get him to do the score to The Good Earth. You have all the, and it's clear they just don't understand each other at all, seemingly. And that story is always told in terms of American stupidity in the face of European high culture and genius, and that is not true.
Okay, that's, I'm curious about that.
Because it is, in fact, a transposition of a culture clash from back in Europe. The studio heads were Polish Jews. They were all Jews, almost all of them, and they were Eastern European Jews who had been looked down upon by the Viennese and the Berlin Jews.
Interesting.
And then they arrive here.
And they have the power.
And they have the power, and there was a payback going on to some extent. It's also the case, and here's something real.
But wait, but let me interrupt for one second, because do you think, though, that, say, in terms of what Hollywood was producing, that they could have made a piece with, say, with Schoenberg or with Heinrich Mann? Or?
Well, it's not with Schoenberg, for sure.
Yeah.
Schoenberg said that he was very eager to do it. He would require twice as much money for it, and he would require that the actors all speak in Sprechtim, in his spoken voice, and he would have to coach all the actors and da 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 da.
Right.
So he was just he was very difficult. But coming back, it's worth remembering that the whole notion of American wholesome culture is a Eastern European Jewish invention.
Right.
It's like, I mean, all this stuff that we think of as 50s culture and, you know, but It's a Wonderful Life, it's all that kind of stuff, including the Westerns, is an invention of Eastern European Jews. And there's an incredible thing which somebody should really, what's his name? There's the avant-garde American filmmaker, his name is going to come to, Ken Jacobs, has done an incredible film where he goes through the Westerns of the 30s and the description of Indians as vermin. All the words that were being used about Jews,
fascinating,
are being used insouciantly by you know, in Howard Hawks and so forth films about the right. Indians. And it's very strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, that gets characterized as American. There's all kinds of washes of culture going on.
Right.
Having said that, coming back to your main point earlier, the novelists and so forth don't really impinge on L.A. culture, for example. I mean, right. You know, what will happen is, the way it will show up in America is that Adorno and Horkheimer are here, living quite handsomely, thank you.
Right.
You know, and then go back to Frankfurt, and from you get from Adorno and Horkheimer into Foucault and that generation. And then you had the catastrophe of the transplantation of French literary theory into American academic life, which, right. I mean, I've often felt that kind of thing was fine as long as it stayed on the with the chimpanzees on the left bank. But the minute it made the species crossing over into American academic life, it was like the Ebola virus had wiped out a generation of.
It did. It wiped out a whole generation.
Absolutely. But oddly enough, that is the blowback of Adorno's contempt
for American popular culture. Right.
Going to Europe and coming back at us.
Interesting. All right, well, wait, let's go back to Brecht for a minute, though, because
okay,
I think...
I'm sorry, I'm not helping. No, I also have the story to read.
That's good.
Okay.
Read the Shelley Winters thing, and then I do want to... Because I think the Galileo thing is really fascinating.
Yeah, it's incredibly interesting, and this will be nice because she talks about that. So she is... So, one of the people who haunted the rehearsals of that production was a young student starlet named Shelley Winters. She'd been offered a small role as a nun, but her studio, Universal, wouldn't let her out of the Western to which she'd been assigned. So instead, as she subsequently called in her memoir, Shelley, quote, "Whenever possible, I would dash from Universal, not even stopping to take off my long blonde wig, and sit in the third or fourth row at the Coronet Theater and watch the rehearsals. Joe Losey, is that how you pronounce his name? Losey?
Yeah.
The director was very nice to me and never objected to my sitting there, but I began to feel that my long platinum hair was distracting the actors, so I moved to the back. One day I noticed a little man who seemed to need a shave and who was wearing greenish coveralls hovering around the back of the theater, picking up pieces of paper and putting them in the trash basket. I assumed he was the janitor and asked him for a program, which he went and got for me. He had a heavy German accent, and I asked him if he was a refugee. He said he was. We sat together and watched the rehearsal. He didn't seem to understand the English too well, and the rehearsals often put him to sleep. He always looked lonely and hungry, so one Friday afternoon I invited him home for the Sabbath meal. My mother still made glorious chicken soup, and to meet my father and mother, who also spoke German. The little man gratefully accepted and enjoyed my parents so much, I left him there playing pinochle with my father. For several months after that, he was there every Friday night. The next few times I went to the rehearsal and so forth, and it goes on, and she tells the whole story about Brecht and so forth, and then at one point. But I didn't discover Brecht's identity until after my father's death, when I was living in New York with my mother and very young daughter and went to see Brecht on Brecht in an off-Broadway theater in the Village. When the curtain went up, to the right of the stage, hanging from the top of the seat, was an enormous picture of my father's pinochle partner. I said to my companion, "What the hell is that picture of my father's friend doing up there?" He turned to me in amazement. "That's Bertolt Brecht." I started to give him an argument, but the people around shushed me and so forth. And, and, uh, And then my mother had awakened and was making us tea. I asked her if she remembered the little German janitor who was a friend of Daddy's in about 1950. Oh, yes, Mr. Brechstein. Did you know, Shelley, after everything Hitler did, that man went back to Germany? Maybe he went back to look for his family. Mother, I said, showing her the book, that man's name was Bertolt Brecht, and he wrote all these plays. He's famous all over the world. With a pitying look, my mother said, Shelley, don't be silly. He was a costume jeweler. Mom, why do you say that? Well, once Daddy asked him what he did in the old country, and he told us he made jewels for poor people.
So here's the question. I don't know if you can add, this just occurred to me now. Why is it that of all the writers in some way, I mean, granted, without breaking through in Hollywood, really, but of all the writers in some way, it was Brecht who both took to, he didn't take to California, but who wrote about it, but also who, you know, was the one who sort of crossed the lines in some way, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he certainly, but he will, I have a feeling he, except for Galileo, he crosses the lines in New York.
Yeah,
and then it comes back here.
Yeah.
It's your fault, not mine.
Well, it's all my fault. It's always my fault.
But it's the New York. It's New York coming to LA, not the other way around.
And then I guess the other thing is, if we to shift sort of beyond, move from out of the exile question and sort of open the conversation into place. You know, what happens afterwards? I mean, how in your sense of it? Because you know. I would also characterize you as an early sort of writer of place in a certain sense, although, as you were saying before we came out, that a lot of those early writings that, you know, you wrote them in New York. You were in New York.
Yeah.
So there is that. That's a different form of exile. How does the writing shift in a certain sense?
Well, I was going to say that the one thing to say, and that will affect my own version, is that the one group, besides the architects, that's really influential is the artists, specifically through three things. Galka Shire brings the Blue Rider collection to Pasadena. That's kind of interesting. Kate Steinitz brings Kurt Schwitters, which is hugely important. It validates the whole collagist, Keenholz, all that stuff comes out of, in a certain sense. It doesn't come out of Kurt Schwitters at all, but Kurt Schwitters allows it to be seen as important art.
Can you elaborate on what's that?
Kurt Schwitters does these collages, very, very, you know, just taping, slapped together and so forth. And it is recognized partly, you know, it's because of Kate Stein, it's partly because it's also collected by the Annenberg, Ahrensberg. I'm sorry. Now I've got them confused in my head. But Walter Ahrensberg had a collection here in Los Angeles, which was the most formidable collection of Marcel Duchamp, of the Surrealists, of Schwitters, people like that. And the key person who goes there is Walter Hopps, who with Ed Keenholz, initially among other places at the Coronet Theater, and then moving eventually to the Ferris Gallery, will found Ferris.
Also on La Cienega.
On La Cienega. And that whole Surrealist tide will come in. Parenthetically, you get, I mean, pop quiz, where was the first Duchamp show in the world? In Pasadena, under Walter Hopps when he was running the Pasadena Museum. But Keenholz, a whole tide of that stuff comes through there, and so that becomes very important and important to some of the writers I write. I don't think Keenholz particularly looked at Schwitters at all, but Walter Hopps had and was immediately able to see something exciting going on when other people wouldn't. So they were validated. When we were sitting backstage, they brought us our parking validation. And they said, "We're validating you."
We felt very good about that. Yeah,
right.
But is your sense that it has become a kind of, I mean, not even, we can even branch out of literature, that it has become a kind of art of place in a certain sense?
Then from that, I mean, Kurt Schwitters had invented that as a place as Berlin.
Right.
And in a similar way, I mean, Keenholz is an incredible, although he came from Idaho.
Right.
He's a quintessential Los Angeles artist for a period, but given permission in some sense by that presence or so forth. And clearly.
And now a Los Angeles artist again. I mean, embraced by LA.
But so that was important. In in my own case, well, I was telling you a funny story about this strange transformation about David Hockney.
Right.
David Hockney, who I also read about, he, around 1970 and 1980 or so, he goes to London, where he had a studio, and he does, from memory, a painting of his house in Santa Monica, his relatively new house, on Mulholland Drive, above Mulholland Drive. And it was a relatively new house, and he paints it in these glorious colors that he had found in California. 3 months later, he comes back, and the actual house is drab compared to his painting, and he paints all the walls and everything to match his painting from his time in London. And it, for example, he paints the stripes on the floor on the bottom of the pool, but he also, all the bricks, he paints really bright red, and he picks the caulking white, you know, bright white, and he, and all the photographs you see of Hockney's house are his making it a home from his London fantasy of it being a home,
right,
and forth. And I think that's Joyce's story. That's a common story.
Right.
And it certainly has been the case with me. In
terms of being 3,000 miles away
and
looking
and
back.
Writing.
You have that great riff at the beginning of L.A. Glows about the light.
It's funny because it has a funny relationship to this, which I'll tell you in one second. This is how I began a piece about the light of Los Angeles. The day of that infamous slow-motion Bronco chase, actually it was already past sundown here in New York as I sat before the glowing TV in our darkening kitchen, transfixed by the unfurling stream of Bob and wafting helicopter images, hot tears streaming down my cheeks. This is the O.J. chase, of course, for those who forget. Hot tears streaming down my cheeks. My 8-year-old daughter gazed for a while at the screen and then over at me, at which point, baffled and concerned, she inquired, "What's wrong, Daddy? Did you know that guy?" "What guy?" I stammered, surfacing from my trance, momentarily disoriented. "Oh, no, I don't know that guy. I don't give a damn about that guy. It's that light." "That's the light I keep telling you girls about. You girls, her mother and her. That light, the late afternoon light of Los Angeles, golden pink off the bay, through the smog and onto the palm fronds. A light I've found myself pining for every day of the nearly 2 decades since I left Southern California."
So let me ask you about that. That's a beautiful passage. It's one of my favorites. But let me ask you about that, the lens of distance, you know, in terms of in terms of your own work, in terms of continue. I mean, you come here a fair amount, you write a lot about
LA themes.
About LA themes, but there is that.
So as to be able to come back here,
it's a good excuse. But I mean, what does that distance give you? I mean, that sense of sort of an exile.
Well, specifically, for example, the light
was
much clearer to me as something when you're living in it, you may not notice it, you're a fish inside the water. You don't.
It's interesting because I live near the tar pits, and my wife and I take a walk several times a week, where we walk through that Hancock Park. That park is called Hancock Park. Yeah. So we walk through Hancock Park by the tar pits. I didn't grow up here, but when I was a kid, we came here, and my only iconic memory of Los Angeles as a kid, as a small child, is of the tar, as of visiting the tar pits.
Yeah.
And as we were walking by this thing for the 8 millionth time, I realized that I have so come to take it for granted that I never even notice it anymore. I don't see it. I don't stop at it. I don't look at it, despite the fact that it does have some kind of iconic personal significance to me. So it's an interesting point.
The light, which Hannah Arendt, one of the few writers who didn't stay here, she said, "I can't stay there. That light makes people mashugana." A technical phenomenological term. Mashugna. I should tell you, by the way, a funny story about that light. I was here 3 months ago, and it was I was in at Art Center because I wanted to see this fantastic show of Other Worlds, it was called, at the Williamson Gallery. That's what it's called. And it was about Mars and various kinds of things that artists are doing with outer space photography. And it was 4:30, and it was just the light on the mountains, because you're right there at the mountains there, and it was just, unbelievable. But the gallery was going to close at 5. And there was one particular thing I wanted to watch, which was this unbelievable video that had been made using actual data of a camera hovering over a crater on Mars, and then going into the crater and all around, and I just wanted to go back. I'd seen it for a second, but I wanted to watch the sunset. But then I wanted to watch that, and it was a terrible nightmare. I was and I was okay. Now I'm going to go look up, and I was going back and forth, and of course suddenly realized that was a video that was made by people at JPL,
right,
who live underneath that sunset, and they'd been sensitized to that light, and it's the same light, the light of Mars. It's the light of LA. In our
that explains a lot. But you talk, when you write about your grandfather, you talk about sort of him having the view in his study and him having to basically buffer himself in some way from the light.
They had great good fortune, or it's actually funny fortune. In 1941, they were able to buy a lot on the hill, on Franklin Street Hill in Santa Monica. You know how there, if you're north of Wilshire, there's that one hill. It's the one hill between the Palisades and the Santa Monica Mountains. It overlooks the golf course. And a lot of shrinks live there. It's called Pill Hill in the neighborhood. But they were able to buy that because it also had the water towers on the top. Mm. It used to be towers, and now the water for Santa Monica is inside that hill. But nobody was buying property on that hill because it was thought if the Japanese attacked anything, they were going to attack that hill. And my grandfather said, we did not, escape Hitler to get hit by Japanese. That's not going to be a problem. And so they built it. So they have this fantastic, incredible view, gorgeous view, almost like a Da Vinci view of that golf course. Whatever else you could say about it, looks beautiful from that hill. And then you see in the distance the mountains, and in the far distance, Mount St. Mary's, which gives it a kind of European quality. And he had this great bay window looking out at that view from his desk, and people would say, oh, no wonder you can compose. You know, you've got the view. He says, when I compose, I have to close the windows.
Now, you've written a lot about this, but just in from the point of view of him as an exile, and again, not to belabor the point, but let's belabor it a little bit. Okay. The idea of you as a version of an exile, is there? Do you see an affinity there? Have you thought about those kind of relationships?
I do... The first way in which I do actually is although I am completely amusical myself, so much so that I am a piece of comic relief in Oliver Sacks's Music Ophelia. He cannot believe that somebody with so much musical genes is just like zilch, nothing. And my problem is I literally can't hear pitch. I'm tone deaf in that sense. But I am completely compositional in terms of my writing. My writing is extreme, so I have that coming through. I also have, interestingly, if anything, I'm in exile from the New Yorker these days. And I quit the New Yorker 10 years ago, and it was the beginning of this pall that came over. I should say this with thanks to you. I mean, My last five books in a row have not been reviewed at all in New York, and in fact the only review the last book got was your review.
It was the only review.
The only review it got, and this is New York Review of Books, so on. And that feels a lot like my grandfather's strange experience. I'm always being told I'm a problem writer in the way that he's told he was a problem composer.
That's interesting. I mean, so then you're an exile. So that's a whole other form of exile sense.
It's a kind of strange thing. But beyond that, though, I do, you know, pining for the light, pining for L.A., something I would say that's important about that generation that began to see itself as at home here is when I was here, I had a really, really wonderfully vivid intellectual life here. Mm-hmm. And it is just, I mean, Steve Wasserman used to say that I couldn't believe it, but it apparently was the case, that LA had the highest per capita book sales in the country.
Right. It goes back and forth, but yes, for a long time it did. I'm not sure what the situation is now.
But when I was here, when I was growing up here, the whole cliche about LA being intellectually boring was just not true. It was just very, I mean, I had friends who were poets, I had friends who were artists, I had friends, you know, and it was just very vivid. And there was no sense for me of an inferiority complex, which parenthetically, the Keenholz, Irwin, those people had not an inferiority complex, but they had the opposite. They had a kind of brash, we don't give a damn. The artists here, so in a sense, what I'm saying is that we like to think we know more than our ancestors, which is true, we know them.
Right.
You know, I it's easy for me to say that I felt intellectually at home here. It's because of that generation, it's Irwin's generation.
Sure.
That seed of the thing that made it possible for you to have that experience of 1970 being a point where you really felt at home intellectually. And I miss it. I mean, I don't have that feeling in New York, oddly enough. I don't, or phrased differently, it can be such a blast of noise in New York that you can't hear yourself. And here it's both intellectual, with there's space, there's light,
right,
to absorb it in.
I think that's true.
You can take walks around La Brea tar pits and kind of...
Exactly, and write books about
them. Right.
On that note, let's turn it over to some questions from you guys. The lights will come up a little bit. There are a couple of microphones, so raise your hands, and then we'll call on you, and a microphone will magically appear in your hands. So anyone, any hands? There's a hand
there's
right here in the front.
Right here, yeah.
And it's attached to a person.
Why not come home?
Why not come home? Reasons of the heart. You know, no, I married a Polish woman, and so the farthest she can make it into America is New York.
Is the island the...
well, actually, we live in Pelham, which is in Westchester, and her bumper sticker reads, "If not Pelham, Europe." and my daughter was raised in New York, but I just thought out of the question that it's still always a possibility. It's you know, the old great Kierkegaard line about vertigo: it's not the fear of falling, it's the fear of jumping. and I'm always on the verge of jumping.
Over here, you said that the sort of European artists and authors who came here didn't really have a huge effect on the literary landscape.
Yeah.
And it struck me, and also were not particularly successful in their works while they were here and influencing the culture. And it struck me that a lot of the, say, mathematicians and scientists who came here under the same conditions actually were successful,
sure,
both in having a historical impact and in just realizing themselves in their work. I was thinking about people like Edward Teller, Stan Ulam, von Karman, lots of other people like that. And I was wondering if you've ever thought about what separated this one group of people who were so effective and this other group of people who were had all that potential, but it never...
One group wrote in numbers, the other group wrote in German. I mean, seriously, in other words, there was an international language that they were able to use. It is, I mean, there's a whole literature on the subject of what happens to one's language when you write, when you aren't surrounded by it. And there's a kind of a great crisis that the Germans who were writing in German were feeling, that they weren't having the dailiness of German back home and so forth. And but you know, that whole group at Caltech was, and for that matter, Reichenbach at UCLA, and there was a whole group of that. They so if you think about it, the ones that we said were successful, the architects, that's international style. And that, by the way, I can do a thing that's the flip side of that story I just told you about film noir, that if you go to the Getty, I was at the Getty one day and I was walking around and I said it reminded me, this is just before it opened, and I said it reminded me of my favorite museum in the world, which was Louisiana in Denmark, outside Copenhagen, and there's a certain kind of in and out and so forth. And John Walsh said to me, well, that's funny because we took Meyer to Louisiana and said, this is what we want. Now, if you stop and think about what's going on there, you had the people who did Louisiana studied with Neutra in California. They were Danish architects. Now go back a step further. Neutra brings international style from Adolf Loos's in Vienna, He brings it to California, invents California Moderne,
right,
which gets studied by Danish architects who take it back to Denmark, and it becomes Danish Moderne, which gets studied by Meyer, who brings it back. And so it's the same story, this tolling back and forth of that kind of influence. But the main point being that writing is different.
Right over there.
And there's a poem over there.
P.G. Wodehouse, he's immensely popular in Britain, but there's a pall cast over him with his flirtations with the Nazis. He lived in Los Angeles. Was he within the literati circle of Jewish-German writers? Or
not so much with the Germans, and then later on he's in Long Island, actually, for Watch the War. But his flirtation with the Nazis, such as it was more his kind of cluelessness about life in some profound sense than he was no Ezra Pound. I know Ezra Pound, and believe me, that was no Ezra Pound. He does show up occasionally, but in some of the memoirs and so forth, but not as much. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a problem of humor not translating.
Right.
And whereas the ones, Johnny Weissmuller is Johnny Weissmuller in any language,
And it strikes me he probably wasn't hanging out with the British writers who they were hanging out. I can't see, say, Wodehouse and Isherwood hanging around together in some way, although that could be interesting. He became a Mets fan at the end of his life when he was living in New York.
So there you go.
Hi, when you talked about the Westerns of the 30s and the way the Indians were depicted, I could take that in two different ways, so I wanted to know how you took it. It could either be the Jewish writers transposing their own experience on the Indians, or it could be them making a commentary of the way the United States treated the Indians in a similar manner than the Germans treated the Jews.
Or a third possibility is the phenomenon, which is at some level profoundly disquieting, and it's the cliche, which is battered children become battering parents. And you would think that everybody says, well, no wonder he's a serial killer. Look what happened to him as a child. You would think, your first thought would be that if it happened to him as a child, you'd be the last person who would do that. But in fact, there's a warpage. There's a weird warpage. Mm. And if anything, I think it's that. I think it's it was a way. It reminds me a little bit also of Stanley Crouch, the great black jazz the critic and other things, and he's one of the fellows at my institute in New York. And one day he said, everything I needed to learn at school, everything I ever needed to learn about politics and about life, I learned in kindergarten on the playground in recess. And it's that 10% are bullies, 25% are victims, and everybody else is saying, not us, them.
Right. No, it's
And that might have been what was going on there, you know.
It's, again, not to turn this into a baseball thing, but there's a great Casey Stengel line where he says the key to managing, which is a version of this, is in any team, they're going to be five guys who love you, five guys who hate you, and 15 who don't really care. And the key to maintaining control is keeping the 15 who don't care away from the five guys who hate you.
But anyway.
That was really great.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, I respect both of your opinions so much on LA literature. Is there anything you've read recently, either that's old that you just keep on going back to, or that is new that you're really enjoying right now, LA?
I'm so glad you said that, because we were talking the whole time backstage. Wait a second.
But it's not LA literature.
No, but it's okay. But I got to get it to you. Just don't go away. I have it right here.
I'll vamp.
You vamp. Where do they put our stuff? I don't know. I can't find it. It's back here somewhere. It doesn't matter. It's John DeGatta and Jim Fuchtel. Is that his
Findahl.
Name? Findahl. Have a book called a new book, that thick, called
The Lifespan of a
Fact. And it is bliss. And what it is John DeGatta, spelled DAGATA, is a writer of writerly nonfiction, creative nonfiction, whatever you want to call it. He's not a reporter, and he wrote this incredible piece about Las Vegas that is, among writers, people really love this piece. It was originally commissioned by Harper's, who would not publish it because they didn't find it reliable factually. It was given to the Believer, and there was a 7-year correspondence between the fact checker at the Believer and Degada. That is the funniest correspondence of all time, and Degada is just kind of fudging things left and right and left and right. And the guy, the great genius, the great discovery is this guy Jim Fendel, who is one of the funniest writers in the world. And they've done it like the Talmud. They have little sections of the piece, and then all around it, there's all these kind the correspondence between commentary. The two of them. And it's being completely misunderstood. It's become the occasion for a thumb-sucking frenzy in the press, which happens every 6 months. Oh, my God, somebody is making things up. Oh, my God, can I live? Can I breathe? Oh, I don't know, I don't know. You know, and both of us agree that it completely misses the point. And it's just, first of all, as a piece of literature, it's great. and so that's wonderful. In terms of... all I can say is find the kindness of strangers. It's a gorgeous book in terms of...
And the Degada is a sort of a companion piece to About a Mountain, which is a book that grew out of the original essay that came out a couple of years ago, which is about Yucca Mountain in Las Vegas. Superb book. And look at both of them. I mean, what he's really doing is sort of saying, color outside the lines. Think about the work on its own terms rather than plugging it into some kind of arbitrary category.
At one point, he says there were 34 strip clubs at that time, and leave it to the fact checker to find out there were 31. And he says, but it sounds better as 34. And what do you care? Is anybody? Are the three going to matter? You know, and they have these hilarious fights about it. And he's actually right.
Right. And it becomes this really interesting sort of two-part invention about this the subject.
So that's a fun book.
We have time for what? Two more? For two more questions, if there are two, there's one right there.
Mm-hmm. As an exiled New Yorker who's been here for 32 years, 4 months, and 5 days.
how many hours?
It's not the light that I appreciate here so much as the skies. I literally drive around taking pictures of the skies. They are very, very beautiful to me. But I wonder if you appreciate the things from New York that I miss desperately. The colors of the autumn are transcendent as far as I'm concerned. And the day that you walk into the streets of the city, that you see the first buds on the trees, it is so emotional. The walk around the Central Park Reservoir is, to me, stupendous. Better than the tar pits. Anyway, here's my offer. If you want to, at one day, if you decide that your wife can bear it here, I'll trade houses with you.
The thing about this, I mean, there are great. First of all, it's a goddamn miracle to be alive on this planet. Anywhere, there's that. In terms of the skies of L.A., there's a great story about a cinematographer. You know, because cinematographers mainly deal with lighting. It's not so much the camera and aiming the camera. It's getting the lights to work and so on and so on. And a guy standing on the Palisade watching one of those sunsets. You know, with just those unbelievable sunsets and. You know, the purple, the mauve, and then the green flash, and slowly subsides, and he leans over to his friend and says, "God, it's incredible the effects that guy gets with just one unit." Did you have you seen the double rainbow video?
No.
How many have seen the double rainbow? Go online to YouTube and look up double rainbow guy. But then, even better, look up double rainbow Donald Judd mashup. Donald Judd, J-U-D-D, the great extreme minimalist artist. Have you seen this?
No, but I will.
You know about the double rainbow. There's a guy who's just freaking out. He's crying. The double rainbow, I can't believe it's double. Oh, I can't believe this. Okay, but then somebody had the wit to go through a Donald Judd show, which is extreme minimalism, and the guy's good, and use exactly the same voice. Oh, my God, I can't
can't believe it. Oh, Jesus. It's so great. It's so great. The clarity. What does it mean? What does it mean?
This is one of the great things ever. Okay, over there.
First of all, I want to thank you for the two books that you did on Irwin and Hockney.
Thank you.
Which were so brilliant and insightful. It was just a thrill to read them.
Thank you.
In passing, you made a remark about French literary criticism.
Oh, dear.
coming to the United States mm-hmm. and the catastrophe that ensued from that. I think I read you right.
Yeah.
I sort of feel the same way. Would you elaborate on that just slightly?
I will elaborate in my trusty way here. I have some of my favorite quotes. I'm going to read you something that will really amaze you. This is Elliot Weinberger. Do you know this from Peanuts and Oranges?
I don't know if I know this, but...
This is just one of the great things. Elliot Weinberger is a wonderful translator, writer, and so forth. And he's giving a talk to a bunch of poets in New York. And we'll end with this. I'm both pessimistic and optimistic about what's happening, and briefly or not so briefly, I'd like to say why. First, I take the word politics in a very narrow sense. That is, how governments are run. And I take the word government to mean the organized infliction or alleviation of suffering among one's own people or among other people's. Is that a great... One of the things that happened after the Vietnam War was that in the United States, on the intellectual left, politics metamorphosized into something entirely different, identity politics and its nerd brother theory, who thought he was a Marxist but never allowed any actual governments to interrupt his train of thought. The right, however, stuck to politics in the narrow sense and grew powerful in the absence of any genuine political opposition or even criticism, for the left had its mind elsewhere. It was preoccupied with finding examples of sexism, classism, racism, colonialism, homophobia, etc., usually among its own members or the long dead, while ignoring the genuine and active racist, sexist, homophobes of the right. And it tended to express itself in an incomprehensible academic jargon or tangentially referential academic poetry under the delusion that such language was some form of resistance to the prevailing power structures. Power, of course, only being imagined in the Foucauldian abstract. Never mind the truly politically revolutionary works, Thomas Paine, or the Communist Manifesto, or Hikmet, or Brecht, or a thousand others, are written in simple, direct speech. Meanwhile, Ronald Reagan, et cetera, et cetera. Is that great?
That's great.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.